back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the new book, The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future, today's guest, Ralph Nader, writes, quote, "Until we manage to shift power away from the few and back to the many, our country is sure to continue its current decline, dragging our lives and livelihoods down with it. But once we start taking back the powers granted to us in the Constitution, our potential for civic enrichment for a better society is limited only by our ability to imagine new possibilities and new realities. Our problems are clear and urgent, but we the people can always find better solutions. Let us begin by looking at ourselves in this refreshing and invigorating way." Ralph Nader shares his ideas about how to improve our lives by re-engaging with civic life, retaking control of the public airwaves, and becoming consumer advocates and congressional watchdogs. He emphasizes that a shift in power from the few to the many will lead to more fairness, less corruption, and economic stability. The question is, how can we reclaim our power and truly shake up this political system? Ralph Nader is a longtime consumer advocate and former presidential candidate. More than 40 years ago, he founded the Public Citizen Tax Reform Research Group to help call attention to how politicians conspire with corporations to game the federal tax system. And his new book is called The 17 Solutions. And Ralph Nader joins us on the line. Hi, Ralph Nader. Welcome to the show. I should say welcome back.
Good afternoon, Rose. Nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. So I'd like to talk about the solutions that you provide in your book throughout the show. But first, I really want to focus on what it will truly take to shake up this political system, this two-party system. And it's a big question. But how do you think people can really reclaim their power?
It's a lot easier than most people think, because we all grow up being told in so many ways, you don't have any power, you can't fight City Hall, you can't take on Exxon, just go along, get along. And there are no civic skill and civic experience courses taught in the elementary school and high schools. So we have generations of Americans who have bestowed their power in the hands of Congress, for example, and the state legislature. And that power has been sold to the highest campaign contributors, mostly corporate contributors, and then turned against the very people who have given this power to our political trustees. And so this book really is designed for a morale boost with content. Most people think the country's going in the wrong direction. They're rather discouraged. They don't know what to do, even though they would like to do something. And so we start in a very simple way. The way to turn the U.S. government around is through Congress. Congress is made up of 535 men and women who put their shoes on every day like you and I. Two senators, one representative. The congressional districts have about 650,000 men, women, and children in them each. So why should it be so difficult to make members of Congress our public servants rather than agents for corporations who keep them in office by supporting gerrymandered districts and pouring money into their coffers? That's a good question. How do we start creating Congress watchdog groups in every congressional district made up of, say, up to 1,000 or 2,000 people for whom this is their major hobby, watching Congress? You know, some people watch birds, some people are in bowling leagues, whatever. This would be their major hobby in their spare time, and they would connect with similar groups all over the country to push for major long overdue changes in our country, like full Medicare for all, living wage, or at least a minimum wage adjusted for inflation, which would be $10 an hour now, based off 1968, getting our soldiers back from Afghanistan, reducing the empire, reducing the bloated military budget, getting rid of most corporate subsidies, handouts, giveaways, and bailouts, changing the tax system so we tax Wall Street speculation, for example, and a pollution tax. Take all that money, put a lot of it into reducing tuition at public universities and public works, repairing America down to the Main Street, Elm Street, repairing the schools, the clinics, the sewage and water systems, the public transit, the dams, you name it, it's in disrepair in this country. And we have good proof of that in annual reports by the American Society of Civil Engineers. Okay, so if we're going to start Congress watchdog groups, how do we start them? Well, first, we get a letter to the senators and representatives, and we say, we are summoning you to a high school auditorium or similar public auditorium on so-and-so date when you're in recess in Washington, and we are going to guarantee you 300 people. Anybody who can guarantee 300 people in an auditorium will be surprised to know that the senator will come personally, representative will come personally. You get them in and you say, look, we're just talking about excessive corporate power, and this is what we want done. Now, that shouldn't be beyond the grasp of people in a congressional district with 650,000 human beings. Every congressional district has at least one or more community college, all kinds of institutes, all kinds of citizen groups running in all kinds of different directions. Once we have these Congress watchdog groups, they can open up two offices in each congressional district and have four full-time people pushing for what the agenda, the long overdue agenda. Now, why would less than 1% of the people be able to change the Congress? First of all, historically, that's what did it. Less than 1% launched the women's right to vote movement. Less than 1% started the abolition movement against slavery in the 19th century and all kinds of other social justice movements. Why can the 1% do it? And we're talking now the other 1%, not the 1% richest that the Occupy Wall Street have publicized. Because as long as the 1% is pushing changes in Washington that will benefit the people of this country and are supported by a majority of public sentiment, as Abraham Lincoln pointed out, 1% is all you need. That's why I keep saying to people, the future of this country is in your hands, and it's a lot easier than you think. A lot easier than you think. And remember, the Constitution starts with we the people, not we the corporation. You still have the power, but you've given it up to legislators and to politicians who are in hock to big corporations. Taking it back is not that difficult.
I think you just said more than I've heard from Obama and Romney this whole campaign season, especially when you went over the list of solutions. And I want to talk a little bit just about the realities that we're facing. So you talk about Congress. And I was just thinking about the Occupy movement. And so many of the people that I met in the Occupy movement are not voting, for example. They refuse to have, well, some of them had a few candidates come out to a couple of protests, but they rarely talk about what you just mentioned in terms of having these town halls, having these watchdog groups, watch your congressperson. What are your thoughts about that and their refusal to take part in the political system?
Well, it's a big mistake. I mean, the first 3 months, they had just the right strategy, I think. They created this wonderful slogan, the 99% and the 1%. They got rid of the internal divisions that would have ripped them apart under identity politics with this slogan, 99%. That unified them. They did these encampments 24 hours a day, which, of course, got them regular and massive mainstream media. And so it worked well up to that point. But then two things happened. The police evicted them, so they lost that base that fed the media. And the second, they didn't prepare for Act Two. And what was Act Two was it needed a victory that was perceived by millions of people gratefully. And what that was, and I talked to about 500 of the Occupy people around the country, would have been to push Congress to lift the minimum wage from $7.25 federal to $10. That would have lifted the wages of 30 million American workers. Just think of that. 30 million American workers are making today, inflation adjusted, less than what workers made in 1968. Now, this is such a modest proposal, but it's a great victory, especially since there are few people victories in Congress these days. And over 70% of the American people polled support it. Even Rick Santorum, and until earlier this year, Mitt Romney supported a minimum wage adjusted for inflation. Obama's on the record as wanting it. It's very important to kickstart the economy, which is in recession. All this money will be spent by people who are spending it for their necessities of life, tens of billions of dollars a year. Small business has already been given 18 tax breaks under Obama, so they've got theirs. And this is what most people don't know. Two-thirds of all low-wage workers are employed by large companies like Walmart, McDonald's.
And Walmart workers just went on strike recently.
Yes. Just think of this. The average CEO pay of those 50 companies that employ two-thirds of the low-income workers in this country is $10 million a year. In other words, that's almost $1 million a month. They make more in a couple days than their employees make all year. So the equities, the economic and moral arguments are overwhelming. And who could have done it? The Occupy movement. They could have surrounded the congressional offices back home with great demonstrations. And everybody would have said, wow, look at that fight. They're really going to get something done. And my read in Congress is that if that was done after the third month, if that was done when the Occupy was at their peak, we would have gotten it. Hmm. Now, just think of how that would have strengthened and enlarged the Occupy movement, which never exceeded 250,000 people. All the rallies, the encampments, and the marches, all together across the country, never exceeded 250,000 people. And look what they did. They put inequality on the map. They got a lot of messages across. And they didn't know how to do Act Two because they don't like leaders. And unfortunately, they don't seem to appreciate leadership.
Hmm. Did you talk with members of Occupy about this?
Yes, from coast to coast. And they all agreed it was a great issue. They all agreed they could do it. But they're not organized. They're not even organized across congressional districts to put the word out. That was part of their charm, you know, that they were spontaneous, no one was pulling their strings. But there comes a time when you have to read history, and there's never a social justice movement in history without there being organization and organizers.
Well, and I'd love to hear listeners on this. If you were part of the Occupy movement and maybe you shunned the political system, what do you think about Ralph Nader's argument that in order to create real change, you have to, in some ways, wrap your arms around these congressional offices, and that's where the majority of the change will come from? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, Rose, the book has good material on things people can do. They don't need legislators or politicians, like expanding community economies. Democratic credit unions, farmer-to-consumer markets, renewable energy where you live, like wind power, and community health clinics with emphasis on prevention. Every dollar you spend in those local community economies is a dollar that's taken away from Bank of America or ExxonMobil or Pfizer or you name it. So they can do that. Nobody can stop them from doing that. But there are other things that they can't do without taking control of the politicians and getting it through state and federal legislatures. And that's reducing our bloated military budget, transforming our tax system, cracking down on corporate crime, restoring our civil liberties. All these, you got to go through the process. You got to take control. Otherwise, it's not we the people. It's they, the corporations.
And that is Ralph Nader. And if you'd like to join us to talk about what it will take to get back our political power, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What questions do you have for Ralph Nader? And what are your thoughts about reclaiming our political power and really shaking up this political system? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Ralph, we have an email from David who says, Is this the October surprise we've been waiting for? President Obama is in town. Ralph Nader is on the radio. Will we hear Mr. Obama fire Biden and ask Ralph to be vice president?
Well, what's interesting is these 17 solutions, which are supported by a majority of the American people, they're long overdue. A lot of liberal and conservative support, too, like the restoring of civil liberties, bringing our soldiers back away from the empire, back home, cracking down on corporate crime. None of these rows were mentioned or discussed in the presidential debate or in the presidential campaign between Romney and Obama or by Democratic or Republican candidates for the Senate and the House. It's like all the things that really affect people and can improve their lives are off the table. And that tells you something, that the mass of the people have withdrawn from the political process. They've left a vacuum. The corporate powers have filled it and are laughing with the politicians all the way to the bank.
Well, and so I wanted to ask you about that. Just give us your analysis of what we are facing with a President Barack Obama and his liberal supporters. You have called him a war criminal, for example. You talk about drones, his foreign policy. I mean, I've met a lot of his supporters who say, well, we can't talk about drones until after the election. What are your thoughts just about where we are in terms of, you know, the people that criticize George W. Bush but don't criticize Obama, and how has that really affected where we are right now?
Well, that has really weakened the liberal and progressive constituency, because when they keep saying wait until after the election, the only time you have any leverage over politicians is before elections and telling the pollsters, whoever listens in April, May, June, September, before the November election, that you've got conditions, you've got demands. If you don't put demands and the politician knows you're going to vote for least worst, why should the politician give you the time of day? He's got you in his pocket. So this idea of a double standard where they'll criticize Bush-Cheney, and then when Obama does the same thing, only in some ways worse, like with drone attacks and civilian deaths and continuing the bloated military budget and expanding the empire, what credibility are people going to give those who purport to be Obama supporters? And so you've got to measure these politicians by the rule of law, by just standards, by the Constitution. And both Bush, Cheney, Obama have systematically, daily, violated the Constitution's requirement only Congress declares war. In fact, Obama did what no other president did. He attacked Libya, which presented no threat to us, and he did it without authorization of funds from Congress, without an appropriation of funds for Congress, without a declaration of war from Congress, without even a war resolution from Congress. He just did it like he was an emperor. He found $1.5 billion somewhere in the Pentagon and attacked. Now, Libya, there's no more dictator, but it's in chaos. It's likely to split into tribes and warfare. And the fighters who fled Libya went into Mali. They now control half of Mali. And here's Hillary Clinton, General Issima, Hillary Clinton announcing that Mali is the latest terrorist tax haven. Well, this is the kind of blowback that the CIA has described from our foreign and military policy. And Obama is just expanding Bush. Bush must be delighted sitting back in his mansion in Texas, collecting hundreds of thousands of dollars in speeches. He must be delighted that Obama not only refused to prosecute any of the Bush administration violators, but he extended what Bush started with Cheney.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's take a few before we go to break. Let's hear from Lewis in San Rafael. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I just wanted to tell Ralph that I'm 52 years old, and I've been following you since your Corvair deal when you took them off the market. And, you know, you could be our only hope. I'd like to see you as a wild card. I'd like to see people on the freeway with signs hanging. You know, in the last minute, everybody vote for Ralph Nader. It wouldn't be the first time your name was on the ticket. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Well, I'm not running this year, but to give you an idea of what should be discussed by our major parties. I've kept my website open, votenator.org, from 2008. Again, I'm not running this year, but you will look at the issues list and you'll say, hey, these issues are still the same. Why aren't they being discussed? Why isn't one party pushing them, like living wage and full Medicare for all, and so many of the things, a Wall Street speculation tax, going after corporate personhood, having national charters for giant corporations instead of being chartered in Nevada and Delaware, where they can rig the system even more. So look at votenator.org and see the contrast. By the way, in California, you can vote for the Green Party. Jill Stein is on the ballot, and they have the same agenda, roughly, that they had when I was running on the Green Party. So you have an opportunity there.
All right. Thank you, Lewis. And after the break, we'll talk more about the Green Party. But let's first take Ed in Santa Cruz. Hi, Ed. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks very much. What I would like to suggest is that the problem with our politics is that the people are uneducated and unengaged, and the politicians are safe behind closed doors, and we never have any dialogue with them, dialogue between citizens and office holders. The same kind of thing that Obama suggested publicly to Mubarak in January of 2011, he said, Mr. Mubarak, you should establish a dialogue between the citizens and the government of Egypt. Well, that's what we should do here. We should pass a constitutional amendment, put the pressure on Congress to amend the Constitution to require all office holders to step forward every 30 days or every 60 days on television across the table from a citizen or that citizen's appointed proxy, such as Ralph Nader or Arianna Huffington or Noam Chomsky or Rush Limbaugh, whoever your man or woman is, to hold real discussions where follow-up questions can be asked and you can pin the politician to the wall and wean them away from the corporate control.
That is a very good point, because the politicians in Congress have a force field around them. You cannot believe how insulated they are, if they want to be, from the public. It's almost impossible to reach a senator or representative unless you've made a contribution of some size to them. They'll put you on with an intern or with an assistant in the office if you're lucky. And President Obama, who came to office saying he didn't want to be in a White House bubble, he says, well, he reads 10 letters in the evening to get out of the bubble. I've sent him 37 letters. He's never replied. He's never even had an assistant reply. They were all substantive letters. No reply. He's refused to meet with 1,000 leaders of national civic groups right down the street from the White House, as Jimmy Carter did. Groups, labor, consumer, environmental, civil rights, women's groups, children protection groups, etc., that have millions of members back home. He won't even go down there, but he'll go to India to push for Boeing products and Harley-Davidson motorcycles all the way to India. I mean, we're seeing here our politicians are in a bubble. The fuel they take comes from Wall Street, symbolically. They cut up the districts, so they're either overwhelmingly Republican or Democratic districts. California is an example of that until maybe recently, because they've depoliticized redistricting a little bit. But basically, 90% of the members of Congress get reelected without any trouble.
Hold that thought, Mr. Nader. We're going to take a quick break. You can join us at 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this. You're listening to Your Call on KALW. To take part in today's conversation, you can call 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, especially when we have full lines like today, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a message at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. And tomorrow we continue our election coverage with a debate about Proposition 39, which would close tax loopholes for multi-state companies like General Motors and Chrysler. Proponents say closing the loopholes will generate $1 billion per year in California, while corporations say Prop 39 will cost jobs. So we'll talk about who's funding the yes and no on Prop 39 campaigns, and we'll also take your questions. That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with longtime consumer advocate and former presidential candidate Ralph Nader. More than 40 years ago, he founded the Public Citizen Tax Reform Research Group to call attention to how politicians conspire with corporations to game the federal tax system. That was more than 40 years ago. And Ralph Nader will be speaking at Wednesday at 7:30 at St. John's Presbyterian Church, 2727 College Avenue in Berkeley. And then on Thursday, the 11th, 7 p.m. at the Cubberly Theater, 4000 Middlefield Road in Palo Alto. And you can find more details at yourcallradio.org. Ralph is author of a new book, The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future. And we've got full lines. We'll have a few open in just a couple minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also post a comment to yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And thanks again for calling in, Ed. Let's go next to John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose.
Hi.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Mr. Nader, how are we going to reform political finance when it costs a couple of million dollars to get elected even to the House? And if we're going to ask our elected officials to stand up to and to oppose and affect legislation or even a constitutional amendment that's a direct contradiction to those to whom they're indebted, that is the corporate money that they've received. And is it really realistic to think that 300 people in an auditorium have the ability to cause that change, given the massive amounts of money it costs to get elected and it's and to carry out the will of those people who put it up?
That's a good pinpoint question, John. The 300 people in auditorium, in community after community in each congressional district, is just a jump start. First of all, you get people there. They have they've already agreed on an agenda, including, say, public financing or public campaigns. They summon the senators and the representatives to these meetings. And then the senator and representatives are not going to be able to manipulate the agenda. They respond to the agenda, number one. Number two, you have a lot of these 300 people auditoriums in the district. That's the beginning of the recruitment for a full Congress watchdog group, the 1,000 or 2,000 people who agree to give 200 volunteer hours a year and fund 2 full-time offices. So these are stepping stones, because a lot of people say, oh, I could, you know, 1,000, 2,000 people, are you kidding? I mean, you can't get 20 people out for a referendum discussion in California. Yeah, but you start step by step. And in those steps, they are interspersed by mass training sessions where people go and learn how to control Congress. The corporate lobbyists know, but we don't learn that in the schools. We don't even know how to write a letter to the member of Congress where it's likely to get a response. I mean, for example, if you're going to write your senator about campaign finance reform and you put forth your proposal, it's a pretty good idea to have a lot of CCs at the bottom of the letter. You CC key politicians who oppose, you CC the media, because that immediately tells the senator's staff that this letter is being distributed around and on the Internet as well as through the mails. So they can't just fluff it off. The second thing you say is, you know, Senator, I've signed this letter with my friend, but if you want me to get 50 signatures on this letter, no problem. Just send me a little note saying you want 50 signatures. That's another way to signal to your senator that you're not going to be a citizen fly by night. Well, there are all kinds of skills, and you can have mass training skills. We had, years ago, mass training workshops to fight nuclear power. back in the 1970s. And 1,000 people came to Washington in two successive years. And they really rolled up their sleeves and learned about nuclear power and its hazards and its diseconomies and alternatives and freedom of information demands and evacuation plans. They went back home, and there wasn't a new nuclear power order for 35 years. So what we've got to see is work on the 1%. That's pretty optimistic. Nobody's saying you got to get 10, 20, 30. You turn that 1% into full-time Congress watchdog groups and backed by 200 volunteer hours. What is that? Four hours a week. Look what people put on their hobbies, for example, far more than that. And Congress, you know, unlike your hobby, spends about 22% of your income and can affect you for good or ill in very, very dramatic and grave ways. So that's what we want to do. It is clear campaign finance has got to be near the top of the list. And my book, 17 Solutions, goes into that, goes into a lot of things people are doing around the country that need to be expanded. It's designed to raise people's morale. People are very discouraged. It's designed to tell them in very practical ways, we've got more solutions than we apply. They are supported by a majority of the people in this country, regardless of what the politicians try to tell us regarding polarization. And it's a lot easier than you think.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, John. Let's go next to Robert in Walnut Creek. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Good morning, Mr. Nader. It's nice to speak with you.
Thank you.
To say one thing before I make my statement and a question. What force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? And I had a question which I've now changed. One of the major issues that I see in this political campaign has never been placed on the table, and I'm trying to understand why, and that's the destruction of the Postal Service and the postal unions. Romney stated in Vermont that was one of his objectives, to go after the postal unions, because if being one of the strongest unions in the country, if he could dismantle that, then all the federal and state unions would collapse. And also, it just doesn't make sense. It shows how our government system, in fact, is corrupt, because it's purposely undermining and destroying an entity which serves millions of people, creates 800,000 plus jobs, affects people on all income levels and how they receive their medicines, their checks, their payments. I'm trying to understand why this hasn't been put on the table as a political issue, because it does affect virtually every American. After all, that company does go to every house every day. So everyone is being affected.
You're speaking to the choir. Great champion I have been for the Postal Service. We've put out two major reports on it. You check our website, essential.org. You'll see some of the things we're doing, a link there. You're right. It's one of the last good-paying jobs for minorities and veterans. It's being strip-mined by the likes of FedEx and UPS and the commercial mailers who aren't paying their fair share, and in many ways mismanaged at the top. I've called for the Postmaster General Donahue to resign. He thinks that he can save the post office by restricting service and increasing rates. That's a suicidal pact. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, why doesn't Obama talk about that? Romney would like nothing better than to turn it over to the private companies, who can then cherry-pick which households they want to deliver to, or decide that if you want to send a letter to Maine from California, it's $10. So you make a good point. It's just another example of where people from the ground up can turn this country around. Now, there's the Postmaster General and his corporate board of directors are slowing down a bit because they're getting feedback from retired postal workers, active postal workers around the country, supporters such as yourself. It's beginning to work. I mean, if people only realized how few protests, how few calls, letters, emails to Congress will put these people up short, They'll have to say, hey, you know, there's a rumble out there. Hey, Senator, my friend, there's a rumble out there around the country. I mean, Richard Nixon signed into law all kinds of laws, like the Environmental Protection Agency, Occupational Safety and Health Agency, Product Safety Commission. He didn't believe in those laws, but he heard the rumble of the people. He was the last Republican president afraid of liberals. He heard the rumble of people coming out of the 1960s. And what was the rumble? A few million people in various marches taking time off? I mean, from their weekend or something? We have to wake up to our own potential, our own strength here, because we've convinced ourselves that we can't beat the big boys. And the history of America in terms of its sequence of justice is that a very few people jumpstart social movements that beat the big boys. Back in the 19th century, what? The farmer populist revolt that swept the country against the banks and the railroads. So I'm glad you raised that, because we need little groups. And in my book, 17 Traditions, I have proposals on how groups can be formed, civic action groups, voluntarily, through inserts in your bank statement, your insurance policy, billing. They're called CUBS for short, and we got one for the Postal Service. We've told 7 postmaster generals over the last 30 years that you need the support of residential postal users, and the way to do it is 2 or 3 times a year you deliver to them a little postcard that says you want to help preserve and expand postal services, join your own post office action group, and you'll have your own full-time champions. They refuse to do that, but we've got to do it bottom up. They refuse to do that. Too bad. We're going to make you do it.
Well, thank you for the call, Robert. I was just looking online for news about this, Ralph, and the Postal Service expects about 20,000 employees to accept a buyout. This just came down today or yesterday.
That's right.
We're speaking today with Ralph Nader. He's author of the new book, The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future. He writes about everything from reinvesting in public works and reducing our bloated military budget to reengaging with civic life and inventing new tools for reform. And if you'd like to join us, we actually have one line open, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Ralph Nader will be speaking Wednesday night, 7:30. At St. John's Presbyterian Church, 2727 College Avenue in Berkeley, and then on Thursday, 7 o'clock at the Cubberly Theater, 4000 Middlefield Road in Palo Alto. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear next from Marie-Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, Marie-Louise.
Yes, thank you very much. First of all, I would like to thank Ralph Nader for going on and working and working, and I admire him very, very much. Thank you. And then I wanted to say that I think we should, first of all, put the health insurance on hold for all the people in Congress until they work for the people also having it as single payer. That would be one thing I think we should do. I also would love it if they could be on minimum wage for maybe at least a year. And they could have travel paid for because they do need to go back and forth, so they should be allowed that. But anyway, yes, because they think that people don't need very much.
Well, that's right in my book. It's surprising. You haven't read the book, and you hit one of the points. It's called Get Congress to Have Skin in the Game. In other words, they don't get any benefits, any health insurance and pensions, unless the rest of the people of this country have similar benefits. That's called moral authority to govern. No double standard. And the second is that if they and the president plunge our nation into war, that immediately all able-bodied and age-qualified children and grandchildren of all members of Congress are drafted into the armed services. That will make Congress pay attention and not give up its constitutional authority to deliberate war-making to a runaway president. Because, right, when Iraq was invaded illegally on a platform of lies, fraud, cover-ups, you know, we know the whole story now by Bush and Cheney. 1 million Iraqis have died, 5,000 U.S. soldiers, 100,000 traumatized and sick, trillions of dollars spent. What did we get for? Al-Qaeda in Iraq, blowing Iraq apart, sectarian violence spilling over into other countries. So this is criminal behavior here. And the way to make it, restrained is to bring the power of declaring war back to Congress. They would have had to have public hearings. There would have been cross-examination. There would have been witnesses, former military diplomat, national security, who opposed the invasion of Iraq, but had great credibility. And Bush and Cheney wouldn't have gotten away with it. So you want to go to war, Congress? You want to go to war, President? Okay, all your able-bodied, age-qualified children and grandchildren will be in the Army, Navy, Marines, or Air Force.
And are you still in D.C.? Do you live in D.C.?
We work here. That's where the capital is.
What is your? Can you give us your assessment of the status of the Progressive Caucus? Because Congressman Dennis Kucinich lost his race, and Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey is retiring soon.
Well, and those are two very good members of Congress, unfortunately. Norman Solomon almost made the top two in that district. It's really quite simple. The Progressive Caucus made up of about 70 members of the House, and they are progressive in their votes, but they have almost no power. They're not organized sufficiently. They haven't spearheaded the move for a $10 minimum wage. When Jesse Jackson Jr., who's a member, put in the $10 minimum wage bill, catching up with 1968, he called it, only 20 members of the Progressive Caucus even signed on. So why is Nancy Pelosi, former Speaker of the House, and she's from San Francisco, why hasn't she gone all over the country trumpeting a $10 minimum wage, catching up with 1968, jump-starting the economy, providing more necessities for low-income people? It's a winning political issue. 70% of the people support it. A winning political issue. You can't get the head of the FL-CIO to take a strong stand and put some ads on, the way they put these insipid ads on these days on television. Why not? Because they're all waiting for Barack Obama, and Barack Obama doesn't want to be accused of being anti-business. Mm. So you have the members of Congress, the labor movement, knowing and believing there should be a catch-up with 1968, a $10 minimum wage, which would lift up 30 million workers. And they're not even doing it because they're waiting on Obama. And Obama is not really running with the Democrats in Congress. He's got a politically selfish campaign, and the members of Congress know that. As a result, if Boehner and Cantor and the Republicans maintain control of the House, as Democratic leaders have told me repeatedly, they don't think they're going to recover the House in November, then Obama can't get anything done because Boehner and Cantor will block them all the time, the way they blocked them in the past 2 years.
I wanted to ask you, since you brought up members of Congress, when you were on our show last time, you said that after the 2000 election, before the 2000 election, you were regularly invited to speak on Capitol Hill and testify at various hearings about consumer issues. And then you said after the election, you stopped receiving the invitations. What is it like for you today? And what's your relationship like with politicians?
Well, I don't testify as much because there aren't progressive subjects being heard in the Senate and the House. And they're still using the scapegoat of, scapegoating Green Party of 2000, even though Al Gore has told me, it's all about Florida and not getting his home state of Tennessee and the Electoral College. He won the popular vote. So these people are very vindictive, the Democrats, against any progressives who challenge them in any way. The corporate Democrats are in charge of the party, and they don't want to be questioned or challenged, and they don't like third parties challenging them, and they've gerrymandered their district, and they got a nice cozy relationship carving up the country with the Republicans, and they don't seem to want to win the House of Representatives by moving such very popular issues as a catch-up with 1968 $10 minimum wage. This may startle some of your listeners. It startled me when I started going the rounds on Capitol Hill and going over the AFL-CIO. They all agree, but they won't take a stand until Obama takes a stand.
And just quickly, and then we'll get to end the show with calls. What are your thoughts on the status of the Green Party? Because I moderated the debate between Roseanne Barr and Jill Stein at a theater here in San Francisco, and I have to say I was kind of shocked because it was half empty. And what I was hearing from longtime leaders in the Green Party is that the party was somewhat decimated when Matt Gonzalez ran for mayor against Gavin Newsom, because you had people like Bill Clinton coming to town to stump for a Democratic mayor. Gonzalez was outspent 10-1, and he lost by only 10,000 votes. But a lot of the leaders in the party said that the Democratic Party really decimated the Green Party at that time. What is your assessment?
The problem with the Green Party is they don't have enough members, they don't have enough energy, they bicker too much. They do not know how to raise money. I mean, nobody expects them to raise $100 million. But they've put Jill Stein out all over the country, and they haven't even raised $500,000 yet. That's disgraceful. So either the Greens are serious, and at one time, about 10 years ago, there were 95,000 people signed up as Greens in California alone. If they can't raise money, and if they can't field local candidates, they may have 200, 300 local candidates out of 2.5 million seats at the local level in towns and cities all over the country. They're not serious. And I've told them that again and again. They expect their candidates to sweat it out on ballot access and be sued by the Democratic Party to get them off the ballot, and their petitioners on the street harassed. And they send them on a presidential run without raising $10 million? $5 million? Cynthia McKinney, I don't think they raised $400,000 for her. So they're not serious. Now, the ones that work hard are commendable, and they should be praised, but they've got to multiply their numbers.
So at this point, I mean, a lot of people feel they only have two choices. What do you think needs to happen so we actually have a viable third-party system in this country?
Well, that's up to the voters. I mean, the voters should vote their conscience. They vote for who they believe in. They should not tactically vote, least worst, or hereditarily vote because their grandparents were Republicans or Democrats. They've got to vote for who they believe in, the party or the independent candidate that has the redirections for our country that are closest to their heart and their mind. And, you know, imagine if everybody did that. We'd have a pretty good politics. Instead, they fall into the two-party trap, the two-party duopoly, and they're told, in effect, either stay home or vote for the least worst. Well, no. In California, you have. You have several small parties, and you should vote for the parties you believe in. You have got the Green Party, you've got the Libertarian Party, other parties, I think, and vote for who you believe in. Aren't we glad that there were a few voters in 1840 who spun away from the Whigs and the Democratic parties and voted for the Liberty Party against slavery? Or the little parties that were pushing for the women's suffrage vote? Aren't we glad that there were some voters that put those issues on the table by spinning away and not voting least worst from the two parties? I mean, you know, let's be mature here.
Well, why don't we finish the show with just a couple more calls? We still have full lines. Let's hear from Molly and Carmel. Hi, Molly. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much. Quickly, I wondered what the role of the DLC is these days. I never hear them referred to anymore. But the basic question I have is this, without having a parliamentary system, how are secondary parties not stripping away, not undermining how do you do it without a parliamentary, a proportional representation kind of a system?
It's very hard. The Green Party in Germany, once they got 5% of the vote, they got 5% of the parliament. Here, you can get 49% of the vote and get nothing. Hmm. So the caller is perfectly right here. What we can do, however, is put a lot of pressure, a pressure by denial, by building up third parties from one side or the other, where the two parties have to shape out, or they know they're going to ship out and they're going to lose to the other major party. Or there could be an enlightened multi-billionaire who turns independent and creates a third-party movement. That may be more likely than any kind of mass movement to reform the system with instant runoff voting, proportional representation, et cetera, that give more voters effective voice. Right now, it's a winner-take-all system.
Well, thank you, Molly. And our last caller is Bob, who's part of Occupy Oakland. Hi, Bob.
Yes, good afternoon, Rose, and good morning, Ralph. I just want to point out that Occupy, is, or elements of it, are still active and working for basic justice. Occupy Oakland has a very active group around an extrajudicial killing of a black youth by the name of Alan Bluford out here. And it's something that, you know, Occupy can only work within the level of mobilization that's there. But the fact is what this group has been doing has been bringing this attention about the abuses of the of Oakland PD to the public. They have been bringing it to the city council. As a matter of fact, last Thursday there was a city council meeting where they got close to 1,000 people out front of the city council there. And you know what the city council went and did, Ralph? They basically went and called out the police, set up all sorts of stanchions, and basically told the protesters that you're not allowed to enter this meeting, a gross violation of the Brown Act. And this is the kind of...
Well, thank you for calling, Bob. We're almost out of time. I just want to get Ralph's response and then final thoughts. We have about a minute left.
The Occupy Oakland gets more turnout than any other Occupy. There's still time for a second act. I would counsel that you move into things like the minimum wage. If you do the street part, it's important for people to peacefully march, but you know, it often falls right into the hands of politicians who turn it into a police situation. And it's hard to prevail in that civil liberty situation and false arrests and all the rest of it. Anyway, I think even for the most militant Occupy types, they got to realize they've got to move into the political sphere, into the governmental sphere, because that's what's blocking on behalf of Wall Street so much change. Any of you who want this book can get it in the bookstores, but if you want an autographed copy for a gift to a youngster, just get to 17 Solutions, spell it out, 17solutions.com. And we'll send you an autograph copy.
Or you can see Ralph in town Wednesday, John's Presbyterian Church, Thursday, the Coverly Theater in Palo Alto. Ralph Nader, thanks so much for joining us and enjoy your time in the Bay Area.
And thank you very much, Rose. Thank Public Radio.
All right. Thank you. Ralph Nader, author of The 17 Solutions, still going strong 40 years after founding the Public Citizens Tax Research Group. Thanks for joining us. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. Should corporate tax loopholes be closed? On the next Your Call, we'll have a debate about Proposition 39, which would close tax loopholes for multi-state companies like General Motors and Chrysler. Proponents say closing the loopholes will generate $1 billion per year, while corporations say Prop 39 will cost jobs. Who's funding the yes and no on Prop 39 campaigns? What questions do you have about Proposition 39? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.